Welcome to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, everybody. Great to have you with us for another episode of This Is Your Journey. Today, well, we have the company of an Australian broadcasting icon for more than 50 years. Ray Warren laid down the soundtrack to some of the biggest moments in Australian sport. The man known as Rabs added spectacular colour to some of our nation's greatest sporting triumphs, including the Olympics and Melbourne Cups. But it was with his beloved rugby league for 99 State of Origin games and 45 NRL grand finals that Warren's passionate commentary became a big part of our land rooms, with a voice synonymous with the code. A member of the Order of Australia and an NRL Hall of Famer, Warren has been imitated on The 12th Man and even featured in popular children's show Bluey. Ray Warren, welcome. It's a great pleasure to have you on.
Well, after that introduction, Sam, I'm going to have to be on my toes, but thank you, yeah.
I don't know how many times my kids watched that Bluey State of Origin episode you appeared in, Ray. It is a very, very good show. I'm fascinated to know, though, surely you'd never heard of Bluey before.
No, I hadn't. No, I can't dodge it. What is it, about 3 years ago now? And the agency rang to say the people from Bluey would like you to put down some voice for a State of Origin version of Bluey, and I said, Bluey, who's Bluey? You know, has he got red hair or who is Bluey? And it turned out to be a dog and several other dogs. I said no, quite definitively. I said no, I don't think that's me. Not as I'm walking into the area of retirement at 78. And they then sort of said, oh, well, fair enough. And my wife said, you should do it for Matteo, who happens to be at the time a four-year-old grandson who is watching cartoons, which I stopped watching about 78 years ago. And I then changed my mind quickly, because when the wife says do something, I do it. And I finished up putting the voices down for the episode of Bluey. So there I was, ignoramus number one.
Geez, you would have been a hero, even more of a hero of a granddad to young Matteo when he heard it and saw it.
Well, he nearly fell off the lounge, you know. we were trying to find the telephone for Triple O, but he couldn't believe Dan Dan, that's what he calls me, he couldn't believe Dan Dan was on Bluey. He'd heard me doing rugby league, but he'd never, in his wildest dreams, thought I'd be on Bluey.
I'd reckon. And how accurate would it be to just suggest here, Ray, that you might be pulled up and asked about this as often as you do, you know, all the grand finals and State of Origins down the years?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm not hiding away from that. I mean, some people think I'm being offensive to the game that gave me a career. It gave me the fulfillment of a dream. Bluey thing, I mean, when you study the facts, I think it's of television, of Australian television, I think it's the biggest export we have.
Yeah, it's massive.
Of course, yeah. I mean, I walk through the bowling club and I'd have four or five people saying, oh, I saw you on Bluey. I look at them and I say, you're in your 80s. What are you doing watching Bluey? Well, they're probably minding their grandkids and watching Bluey at the same time.
That's it. You mentioned 80s. You had a big birthday last year. You turned 80. So where do we find you, Ray? And if I may be so bold as to ask, how's the health and how is everything going?
I'm okay. I've had some prostate problems inside the last decade or so, and I'm still dealing with that. But other than that, I think I'm a sprightly 80-year-old.
Awesome.
Other than that, I find it difficult to fill the time up, although I don't know why I feel like that, because I finished up doing, on average, about one match a week for the last couple of years. So why I feel the way I do sometimes, I don't know.
We are actually speaking for context here in the same week as the NRL obviously embarks on something that it's never done before, Ray, and that is a pair of season-opening clashes in Las Vegas, Nevada, in the US of all places. Now, it strikes me that yours was a style that, geez, might have been right at home in Sin City, Ray, to be honest.
Yeah, I guess I could have had a bit of fun with it. Yeah, I don't know what I'm remembered for, to be quite frank with you, but I think what added to whatever I've done was spontaneity. You know, I didn't write things out knowing that I'll get to use that sometime in the next 80 minutes. And from that spontaneity, you know, came the miracle try. And
trailing 12-10, Langer pushing it wide. Walters onward. Khan joins in. Floats the pass for Renoff. Renoff down the touchline. Beats one. Gets it in field. Hancock gets it on. Queensland are coming back. Darren Smith for Langer. Langer gets it away.
somebody stop him, he'll run out of the stadium.
28 metres out from the Canterbury line in Brisbane, putting another attacking wave together. Kerrod Walters out wide for Alan Cann. Cann beats him. He beats centre, goes inside the 10 and the 5. Oh! Somebody stop him! He'll run out of the stadium!
And all that sort of stuff that I used to come out with. But I think spontaneity is the word I'm looking for. But I would have had a lot of fun, I think, in Las Vegas, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Far be it for me to say. But entertainment is the word that comes to mind. You'd be remembered for entertaining us. And this is the entertainment capital of the world. Although, to do it, Ray, you would have had to fly there. Now, I've read a lot, but just how real, how serious, how deep was your fear of flying, particularly early on in your career?
Well, I come from a railway background. My dad was a fettler and he laid the railway lines, and we had a silo where Mum weighed the wheat. She was the only woman in the history of the railways to own a weighbridge man's license, and my brother was a boilermaker on the steam engines, and I was a fitter and turner as an apprentice on the same things. But, you know, they'd look up into the sky, and Mum and Dad I'm talking about, and say, well, if you were meant to fly, you'd have wings. And you can only say that a few times to a youngster growing up, and suddenly it becomes embedded. And I was raised on the diet of the railway as the safe way. But it wasn't an experience on an aeroplane that caused me to not like flying. Eventually, when I came to Sydney and started in radio in 69, I had to fly, and I didn't enjoy it. Turbulence, all that sort of stuff. I just didn't enjoy it. I don't like height, but I was reminded that I better get used to it when I got, I won't say sacked, but Channel 10 waved goodbye to me in 1986. And one of the major reasons for that was I'd pulled out of the LA Olympics through the fear of flying. And that was an honest answer. And then I had to sit 5 years on the sideline thinking the fear of flying cost me my dream, you know what I mean? Or interrupted my dream, put it that way.
Well, that probably answers my question, doesn't it? You get a chance to call the 1984 LA Olympics, and you know, your fear of flying stopped you from doing it, so that probably tells you how serious it was at the time. But you mentioned you learned to not get over it, Ray, but you navigated it, I suppose, going forward. Now, I did read something where you had a couple of rules with flying as you went through your career. You never flew before midday because you just had to have a scotch or two to calm the nerves, and you can't be having a scotch at 10 a.m. otherwise people think you've got a problem.
Absolutely. Yeah, you've answered your own question. Yeah. Why didn't I like flying before midday? Let me make one thing very clear, though. I'm not talking about match day. I would always go a day early, and I'd book on a plane after midday so I could sit back and have a Chardonnay and not look like I was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
unlike a friend of mine who was sitting next to me coming back from New Zealand, it was, I think, 4:30 in the morning Sydney, and we took off from Auckland at 6:30 in the morning, and he ordered a glass of red, and then he proceeded to drink the bottle, and I'm sitting next to him thinking, geez, you must have a problem. But many people probably thought I had a problem, but yeah, that was I needed to sit next to a window of all things. I demanded a window.
Right.
And
why
I
is that?
Scared of heights.
What?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't answer your question. I can't answer your question, Sam, but yeah, I didn't mind on a smooth flight looking out over the territory, particularly between here and Melbourne, with all of the canola crops and the brown soil that had just been ploughed up. It was a beautiful picture, but it was always after midday.
Yeah, well, whatever it took to get through, and thankfully you were able to as your career unfolded.
Yeah, I think the cap on that story is that after 5 years, I then got the chance to come back into the media, not so much the media, but to come back into football. And that's when I knew I had to learn to fly. Come hell or high water, I had to fly. And the swimming took me around the world a couple of times, really.
And we're going to talk about swimming. We're going to talk about flying. We're going to talk about it all, Ray. And it's great to have your company out there as well, because you're listening to This Is Your Journey. It's all thanks to Tobin Brothers. They're a family-owned business. They have been since 1934. So from the Riverina to broadcasting's bright lights, we're going to retrace Ray Warren's path to the small screen.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, great to have your company on This Is Your Journey. It's made possible by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Australian broadcasting icon Ray Warren is today's guest. So, Ray, let's go back. You're born in Junee, New South Wales, on the Riverina there. There's Am I right? There's actually a statue of you there now, isn't there? You're immortalised in bronze in the town?
Yeah, that's right. It started off pretty much as a joke, but eventually it became a reality, and it stands there. And when I look at it, I'm a little bit humbled and a little bit embarrassed, but right now quite proud of it, yeah.
Oh, as you should be. And I've never been a Junee, but I was just doing some research on the town. It actually, how fitting is this? It takes its name from the Wiradjuri language, which actually translates to, well, we think translates to, talk to me.
Talk to me.
Yeah, talk to me. And you did plenty of that over the journey, so it's amazing how
these
things...
I guess I did, Sam, but, you know, I don't, you know, I back in the early days, I mean, we only got the races once a week at Junee. That's the only broadcast of races we got. And then this thing called television came along, and people then probably, they then suddenly realised that this young bloke from here is working on metropolitan television. So he must be doing okay. And I guess there comes the story of the statue. But Junee, yeah, it's a little railway town, or, you know, mainly railway back in those days, but in the middle of the breeding ground of our agriculture. Doesn't matter what sort of agriculture, doesn't matter whether it's a sheep or a cow or whatever, beef cattle, but it's right in the middle of a very productive area of Australia, and it's halfway between Sydney and Melbourne.
Am I right to say your mum and dad love the races, love the punt, and they sat glued to a fella by the name of Ken Howard, I think it was, on the wireless back in the day? And it is amazing how often this seems to be the case for people in your line of work, but the desire to commentate, to call, to describe what's happening might have just been in the blood from the start, but listening to Ken, I imagine the seed was sown right.
Yeah, Ken Howard was the best race caller of his time. He was the best race caller up until that point in time. He was the best race caller the world had ever heard. And John Tapp became his understudy, and then I became understudy to Ken and John. And I had watched, I had listened to Ken every Saturday, because Mum and Dad loved to have a gamble up in the kitchen at home at Junee, little weatherboard home. And this man, he fascinated me with the colour that he brought to the kitchen, broadcasting racing, as I said earlier, only once a week, but that's when we had the time of our lives, and I'd ride a broomstick around the kitchen table. We lived in the kitchen. We didn't use the lounge room. But he just became ingrained in my thoughts about my future, and that's when I started rolling marbles down a slope when I was 8, calling them as horses. And then I rose after quite some time. I became an understudy to the man, stood next to him, got him cups of coffee, all those sort of things, and it was just a wonderful part of my life to stand next to him and then broadcast races under him and John. So the dreams became true. People talk about, oh, you never know, a dream may come true. And they do. They do, I promise you.
You mentioned the Fitter and Turner apprenticeship. You left home to do that, but you went into the police force, didn't you? And I'm not sure how long it took you to realise that it wasn't for you. Was it when there was a four-car pile-up on your first day as a traffic cop?
I didn't leave home to become a fitter and turner. You didn't have to. The railway at Junee was the biggest thing in the Southern Hemisphere.
Right.
The roundhouse there, it's a wonderful building. As I said, it was the pulse or the heartbeat of Junee. But when the steam engine expired, basically, it was replaced by the diesel locomotive. So there was no need for a grease monkey like myself anymore or a boilermaker like my brother. And I followed my brother. My brother went in the police force here in Sydney, so I followed him into the New South Wales Cadets. And then later I joined the ACT police force, and I wasn't cut out to be a copper. What you're alluding to is the traffic cop. One afternoon I was doing point duty on Commonwealth Avenue, I think it was, and I created a four-car head-on collision. So I wasn't meant to be a traffic cop, and thrown into the bargain, I had to lock up a couple of SP bookmakers. And Mum and Dad used to have an SP bookmaker come there to take their bets every Saturday morning I was riding the broomstick around the table, thinking I was Ken Howard and pretending to be George Moore, and here I am locking up SP bookmakers.
That literally is too close to home.
Yes, but it was also quite humiliating, you know, because I locked up a couple of blokes that went to the hospital every Sunday and gave gifts out to the kids that were recovering in hospital.
You'd earlier done some door knocking, though, hadn't you, at various radio stations, and I'm assuming it was that sort of door knocking, Ray, that was about to take you in a very different direction from the police force, and that would end up obviously shaping your life. So radio station 2LF was in Young, New South Wales. You took the job, I think, as a sales rep. a trotting caller, and you did a bit of rugby league as well. So this is where it all began, I assume.
Oh, yeah, that was my first taste. You're quite right. I went to Sydney in the police cadets. You wouldn't believe it. The first week I was there, I knocked on the doors of three or four radio stations, and the only one that really gave me a hearing was 2GB, Mankle Garth Carey. He listened to my tapes, and they were simulated, but he said, look, why are you trying to sound like Ken Howard? I said, because I thought he was the best. He said, no. He said, you've got to bring something fresh to the table. That's what people want. And they owned about five or six radio stations in Australia, Macquarie Network. And it was 5 years after that meeting with Garth that I got a telegram from 2LF saying, do you still want to be a sports commentator? And that's where it started. And his first question was, can you call football? And the answer to that is, with my hand on my heart, no. But I told him yes, because I was confident I could do it.
And there was 2GB after that. I guess your biggest breakup until then was, you know, moving to Sydney, calling the old Amco Cup, I think it was, on Channel 10 midweek. But the breaks kept getting bigger, didn't they, Ray? The Melbourne Cup came next. Now, narrating the race that stops a nation. So Beldale Ball was the winner that year. I think the prize money, amazing to think it was $310,000 the year that you called it. What level of anxiety did you hold within, though, at the responsibility of calling something like the Melbourne Cup?
Oh, well, you know, it was a major part of my dream, Sam. You know, I set some little goals in this dream, you know, like an Olympic Games or a Melbourne Cup or a grand final, whatever. State of Origin hadn't been heard of back in those days. But the Melbourne Cup was a major part of what I wanted to do in life. And I hadn't had a lot of experience calling the real thing. The major thing I'd ever done was call marbles. But a fellow from Melbourne called Brian Morris was the boss at Channel 10, and he knew me well. We used to play tennis together. And one day, he called me and said, do you want to call that Melbourne Cup next week? And I said, well, not next week, next month. And I said, I'd love to, you know. So I did the broadcast of the Melbourne Cup in 80, 81, 82 to the New South Wales and Queensland audience, as opposed to the Victorian audience. But I was very nervous because I was coming off a diet of calling maybe one meeting per month at Gosford or somewhere, which is a very small track. Flemington, I couldn't believe a track could be so big. And I borrowed from Carl Zeiss, I borrowed a pair of 1560 binoculars, which gave me every chance. But going into a thing as big as that, I was very, very nervous. I mean, if I had my time over again, I'd probably put a bit more zig and a bit more zag into it. But, I got through it satisfactorily without being, you know, I wasn't doing handstands.
It's a bit like a high jumper at the games, isn't it? Like the bar keeps being raised. But were you one to ever lie awake at night, Ray, thinking, you know, am I good enough? Should I be here? Can I do this? Because what you do is performing in a way. I mean, there's no stage, but there's an audience. And thinking about the size of that audience could be overwhelming, I'd imagine.
Oh, absolutely. You're quite right. You know, you touched on something earlier in the interview where you mentioned the word entertainment. And, you know, there's a proportion of people in the industry don't realise that is the major word, in my opinion, in both radio and television. Entertain. It's just so, so important. And I really can't extend that thought any more emphatically than I am. You're lying in bed and you're thinking, God, there's an Origin on tomorrow night and there's going to be 4.5 million people watching it. Or, oh my God, I'm going to call the Melbourne Cup and I'm going to be in the box next to Bert Bryant or Bill Collins or Joe Brown, or to bring it up to date, Greg Miles and young Hilly, he's going gangbusters at the moment down there.
He is. So your career's on the up and up, and we touched on it before, but Channel 10 obviously took the decision to let you go, to fire you, to sack you, whatever word you want to use, largely because the fear of flying prevented you from going to the LA Olympics in 84. So I guess it's the first real setback in your journey. But I wanted to relay a quote to you that you said at the time. And I think you said, just because someone takes away the bike, it doesn't mean you stop pedaling. Now, you said that and you went back to the bush, really, and you kept pedaling, greyhounds, paces, trots, the lot. So that would have been, I'd imagine, if you can take us back, Ray, enormously demoralising, but you weren't going to let it finish your story, were you?
You're probably being a bit kind to me, but you're spot on. That's what I did. I don't know what it was called then. I don't think it was called Sky Channel. I think it was called Club Superstation or something like that. Graham McNeice was the founder of it. Great man, great friend. And he made sure that I got to call some greyhounds or did some hosting or whatever it was. So I had to make a dollar. I had a family to look after. I never lost sight of that. I wasn't going to sit over in the corner and moan for the rest of my life. And then 5 years on, out in the wilderness of the entertainment world, Ian Frickberg, he rang me from Channel 9. He said, "Do you still want to call football?" Mm. I said, "Yeah, of course I do." And he said, "How long are you going to take to think about it?" I said, "I've already thought about it." I said, "When do you need me?" He said, "We start next year." And that was 1991, and we started in 1992. By then, Nine had the Origin, and now Kerry had bought the whole kit and caboodle. I really started full-time with Nine in 92, and it ended in 21.
Yeah, it went right up. I mean, so some of these names, the late Darryl Eastlake, the late Jack Gibson, I mean, did it feel like a home in that commentary box? And did you have, what was the relationship with Kerry Packer actually like, Ray?
I didn't really have one, Sam, to be honest with you. I was sort of scared of the bloke. He was an intimidating figure, and I'd only ever heard stories about his gruffness and how he lectured people and all the rest of it. If he came on site, I'd go missing. And to be honest with you, the only time I shook his hand was at James's wedding to Jody Mears. When he shook my hand, he wasn't looking at me. He was looking at his wife and telling her, "You can't talk to every one of the guests, Roz, because there's 150 and they're lined up and they're all getting drowned out in the pouring rain." And at the same time, he shook my hand and ushered me with the other hand into the reception area. So that was my only contact with the man. I can honestly tell you, I thought he hated me. But then after his passing, John Cornell, who was very close to him, Strop, he said, no, he said he actually liked you a lot. I thought myself, oh, shit, I didn't know that, you know.
It's probably one of those things, if you didn't hear from him, you knew that he liked it. If you heard from him, maybe he didn't. But
I think that's right. Yeah.
We're with the great Ray Warren on This Is Your Journey. It's all thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. There's so much more to come, so stay with us.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, we hope you're enjoying this week's edition of This Is Your Journey. Today's guest is one of Australia's most celebrated sporting commentators. It's Ray Warren. So, Ray, you did it for so long, so I'm really keen to know, what makes a great sports caller in your mind? What are your long-held beliefs? What are your non-negotiables when it comes to broadcasting sport?
I think I've largely answered that for you when I use that word entertainment.
Yep.
I listened to the radio as a kid, as you know, and Ken Howard, he fascinated me with some of the things that he brought to us in the kitchen at Junee. You know, this horse coming down the outside underneath the roses at 100 miles an hour, and he was betting London to a brick on that it'll get this photo, and all of this stuff, you know, it all fits under the heading of entertainment. And then along came your Bert Bryans, who was another idol of mine, you know, good friend too. And he was the entertainer of race broadcasters. You know, he could have you laughing even though you'd back a 6-4 on chance and it got beat. He could still have you laughing, but he knew the major requirement, in my opinion, to be successful in commercial radio or television was to entertain.
I'm not sure if you can put this into words or not, but take us inside the commentary box, because yours became a style, I guess, that had that, I don't know, that simmering of adrenaline, but it could explode when the play demanded it in seconds. Were you just on the edge of your seat, just trying to anticipate, trying to wait for that moment? And when it did, you wanted to give your voice the gravity that the occasion demanded?
Probably not necessarily expecting or waiting for it to happen. But one of the things I say to young blokes coming through who want to talk to me and ask me questions, I say light and shade. There's no need to be excited all the time. There's no need to be screaming at the audience all the time, because it's not that exciting all of the time. What you have to do is ride the wave, which I used to get from my crowd. If the crowd was excited, so was I. And if they weren't excited, I was down there with them. And I think it's a very important part that I don't think some young commentators quite get it. Not every minute of every event is exciting, and by the injection of light and shade, the up and the down, the ride of the wave, the crowd noise, let them govern your excitement. That was a very important part of the way I thought.
Darren Lockout, he kicks, Slater's picked it up. Was he onside? Slater down the ground, he kicks again. Here
We mentioned the nerves that you had, or, you know, before your inaugural, your first Melbourne Cup. Did you have those nerves? Did you feel like that right up until your last NRL game or your last Origin game? Was that a feeling that never left you? Or did it just become, you know, another day at the office after a while?
No, never. No. I never went to work not wanting to go to work. You've got to understand, unless there was a plane, if there was a plane ride.
Yeah.
I'll take that back. Yeah. But at the end of the day, I never went to work not wanting to go to work. I never had Mondayitis, which is an old saying, but I loved my job. My job wasn't a job. It was a toy. It was a hobby. It was a pastime. It was my love. So, I mean, the nerves thing, they never, ever left me. But I can assure you that the nerves were at their highest level when they went onto the track for the 1980 Melbourne Cup. And there I was. I knew I didn't have the preparation that I really needed to give it my best shot. I just wanted to get through it safely and come home comfortable, you know.
Yeah.
But the nerves of the size and the magnitude, not only of Flemington, but the audience that you can imagine. And the event, as you know, was the number one day on the sports calendar in Australia, and probably still is.
Yeah, but the nerves are good though, aren't they? Because ultimately, it's our nerves that keep us sharp, because I'd imagine complacency, you know, that would be your worst enemy, getting, you know, too comfortable. And when you are doing it for so long, Ray, is there and you are following guys' careers, you're seeing them come into the sport, you're seeing them go out of the sport, you know them intimately. Is there a challenge in staying objective rather than subjective? What I mean by that is, you know, it has been said by many people that they never heard you criticise a player.
I'm proud of that, to be honest with you. I was reminded of it in a testimonial, or what do you call it, a documentary that they did on me. Brad Fittler, he said, the thing I remember about Rabs is that he never once bagged a player. And I didn't. And the reason, I think I tried to adopt a policy that if there's something, and this is about life generally, if there's something you can't do yourself or you haven't done yourself, then you really haven't got the right to be critical, you know. So, I mean, if a kid absolutely missed a tackle all up, I'd find a way to try and make an excuse for him. And sometimes it can bite you on the bum too, you know. The people that are prepared to go out there and say things controversial and all the rest of it, no matter, even if they're bagging the referee or bagging a player, they tend to get on more so than the old fox who goes through his career of 55 or 60 years and never bags anybody. You got to make a choice. And Ken Howard, again, there's that name. I did actually bag some jockey one day, and he pulled me up after the race. He said, "Why'd you do that?" I said, "Well," I said, "he was four deep in a field of six." He said, "Mate," he said, we don't bag people, you know. He said, "You want to go home and sleep at night, don't you?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, mate, we didn't come here to bag the people that make us do what we're doing." Those words rang in my ears for years. And John Tapp, ditto, Johnny Tapp. He and I were the members of Ken Howard's classroom. So if I did wrong, then I'm sorry. But I think I did right.
Yeah.
By refraining from bagging people that were doing things that I couldn't do. I mean, I couldn't referee a match. I knew the rules, but I couldn't referee a game. You know what I mean?
Very interesting. It's very interesting. You ended up going to three Olympic Games, Ray. I want to ask you, what did top-level international swimming bring out in you? Was there a heightened sense of intensity that, you know, patriotism brings?
Oh, yeah, you can't help it. I mean, I used to be a bit critical of co-commentators in particular, screaming and shouting and, "Come on, Billy, come on, Tommy." You know, I used to think, "Oh, please shut up and let the play-by-play commentator and let him call this race for us," you know. But then I remember Susie O'Neill. I listened to it back. Not every day, but every year. And, "Come on, Susie, you can do it."
Yeah.
"Come on, Susie. Come on, Susie."
The line's coming. The line's catching you.
Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, you became a barracker and you're a broadcaster. What are you doing? But I can't take it back. It's there, you know. So I don't know whether that answers your question, but
yeah.
Peter Sterling, Paul Vorton, Rex Mossop, there's the best example. Rex Mossop, he loved Manly and he made it known that he loved Manly. Paul Vorton, he loved Queensland. He would have Queensland for breakfast, lunch and dinner. I don't mind people being biased, but when they start screaming over the top of the play-by-play commentator, which I was, then I'd get a bit edgy, a little bit cranky.
And did you ever have to offer a none too subtle reminder to your colleague, maybe during a break in transmission, that stay in your lane?
No, not really. No. Again, they were entitled to become patriotic. They were the ones that are entitled to criticise. Because they'd been there, done that.
Research, I mean, it's an obvious one, but how critical is it as a caller? I mean, you mentioned Susie O'Neill, so your calls of Susie down the years, Madam Butterfly became, and they did become, the stuff of legend. Is that to do with the fact that you knew her story, her dreams, her aspirations, the pressure she was no doubt under to perform?
He breaks an 18-year-old record held by Mary T. Maher, the American. And Susie was chasing it like a greyhound at Sandown or Wentworth Park. You know, she was chasing it. And I was about 2 or 3 years on the bandwagon chasing it with her. And we all, you know, Nicole Stevenson and Duncan Armstrong, we were all riding with her. And by now there's a red line in the pool with her, you know, and you can see that she's going to do it, but she's getting tired. Oh, yeah, no, you can forget sometimes that you're a broadcaster. There's no doubt about that.
A bit's been said over time too, Ray, regarding your powers of memory. I'm not sure if that was harnessed, something you had anyway, but harnessed with the police or sharpened over time. But tell us about your ability to remember.
Oh, I don't quite know where you're going, but I'll take a guess. And I mentioned the SP bookmakers. I once went into the pub where I would drink often, but I went in dressed in a pair of thong shorts and T-shirt and placed a bet with an SP bookie. And I said, mate, I'm sorry to tell you this, but you're going to have to come with me. You're under arrest. And he said, what, are you a copper? I said, yeah. Oh, he said, oh my God. He said, how long is this going to take? I said, oh, a couple of hours. He said, well, look, he said, I've got to work at the races this afternoon. He said, can we hurry? He said, can we go in my car to the station? I said, absolutely. I'll come with you. You drive. That'll quicken our journey. He was driving a black Mercedes ACT 1234. Never forget it.
There you go.
Can you believe that?
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, I can, because in all the tributes to you, a lot of people anyway, speak of your ability to remember, which is a bloody important skill set, I'd reckon, for your old line of work.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll be standing with mates watching a race and something will come around in colours and I'll say, they're the colours of old Burnborough. They're the colours of the Romanos that own Burnborough. And, you know, the colours are still in my head of a lot of horses. And a lot of the colours are going around today as we speak. And I can look at a race and I know where it is and who it is and who owned it and all the rest of it. But that stuff doesn't leave you, you know.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey. It's thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We'll be back with Ray Warren after this.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
It's been great to have your company here on This Is Your Journey. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. And we've had the company today of one of this country's best ever commentators, Ray Warren. So, Ray, just a couple here. That's not a try, it's a miracle. You can turn the light out now. The man is a messiah. Age shall not weary them. Hang on, Susie, we've raised already. But what stands the test of time for you? I mean, everyone has their favourite memories of you in the box, but what immediately springs to mind as one of or some of your favourite moments? What gave you the most joy in calling?
Oh, you know, I'm reminded every year at Origin time of the miracle try. Just to explain, you know, it went through 11 sets of hands. It came from the eastern side of the ground across to the western side and then back again. And somewhere along the line, as I said to you earlier, much earlier, spontaneity kicked in and I called the try, scored by Mark Coyne, and I said, that's not a try, that's a miracle. In the background, you can hear Fatty going, oh, yes, Queensland, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And I can't underrate the memory that brings back to not only myself, but a lot of people, you know. When I called my last game for Channel 10 in 86, it wasn't a fond memory, but I think I said something, I'm high on disappointment, but I'm low on regrets. And that might have been a bit of Shakespeare coming out in me, but I was hurting. Deep down, I was hurting because I thought my dream had ended in 1986. But anyway, it didn't. I came back, and here I am talking to you about what was a wonderful career for me, but a wonderful life given to me by the big bloke upstairs, yeah.
We mentioned Bluey earlier. Now, that's for the youngest generation. I guess the 12th man is for people of my generation and older, and for people like us, it'll live on forever. Ray, did you take it as an honour that Billy Birmingham would take such great delight in imitating you? You know, dead set and crunching tackle and all those sorts of things?
Originally, to tell you the truth, no. In fact, a couple of footballers one night, we were all having a drink, as it was with the Amco Cup. We'd go to Lismore or we'd go out in the country and we'd all convene on a bar somewhere, and suddenly you and the players are all in together. And a couple of them started taking the mickey out of me, and I fronted up to them. I said, what do you think you're doing? You know, I used to get aggravated by it. And I shouldn't have, because more lately I'm flattered by it, and I should have always been flattered. To sit alongside in an album from Billy Birmingham doing imitations of Tony and Richie and Bill and all those things, I mean, why the hell did I get cranky about it? No, I should have been flattered, and right now I am flattered by it, you know what I mean?
Hello everyone, I'm Ray Warren. Welcome to Nine's wide world of sports coverage of this first VB Series final between Australia and New Zealand.
Not bad, Ray.
Well, Anzac's spirit probably put on hold temporarily today as Steve Waugh and his men take on the Sheepshaggers from New Zealand.
That's good.
The traditional sporting foe from across the ditch.
That's great.
It really has been a magnificent series so far, this VB Series. And it's the cricket box led by Sean Pollock. Dead set unlucky, you'd have to say, really, in the fair income department. You look at the comparison between the two run rates, and gee, there's only a 15th in it.
That's good.
So we'll take a look at the two teams for you now. Firstly, the boys from Aotearoa are almost unchanged, the lineup. Astle, Bell, Martin, McMillan, O'Connor, Fleming, the captain. Richardson, Perore, Sinclair, Tuffy, Vittori, and on the bench is Franklin.
Wow, I like it. Now, this is super stuff.
Tony Gregg is the man with all the facts about the cracks and any glitches with the pitches. And Tony's pitch report is coming up on the other side of this commercial break.
Ah, now that is good.
Did you have any sort of relationship with Richie Benno? Was he of a similar mind?
Well, not really. I don't want to sit here and tell you lies, but the few times I was in his company, I loved being in his company, you know. And he and Daphne used to watch the football every weekend, and he taught me a few things. Like he said to me once, I only ever talk if I think I'm improving the product. When you think about Richie Benno's commentary, he was saying there's no need in television to over-talk it.
Mm.
One word's enough, and in his case, it was marvellous. And then there was a time when a young commentator he was working with was there when Warne in England got out on 99, Shane Warne, 99, and the young commentator said, that is a tragedy. That is a tragedy. And Richie said nothing. And back at the hotel, he called the young commentator over and he said, you know, when Shane Warne got out, he said, you said it was a tragedy? And the kid said, yeah, it was. And Richie said, no. He said, a tragedy is kids dying every moment of every day in third world countries through starvation and disease. And he said, tragedy is, well, to use some modern day examples, Israel and Palestine and all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
And he straightened the kid up straight away, you know. And I remember myself saying, oh, that's a tragedy, you know, because I've had my money on a thing that got beaten by a nose. That's a tragedy. No, it's not. No, it's not. And that was Richie Benno, the one that I knew.
Yeah. Tragedy for the wallet, maybe. You clearly, though, Ray, weren't one for doing things for posterity, though, given your retirement. Well, I mean, what was it, a week out from Origin 1 in 2022, and that would have been Origin 100 for you.
Yep.
Did you agonise over the decision, or was it just the timing was right, or can you let us in on the decision itself?
Yeah, I agonised. Yeah, I did, a lot. and I delayed retirement. I did the 21 grand final. You've got to understand that the last year of my career, I was calling Origin and Grand Finals from the studio because of COVID, and that frightened me that I was going to do something I'd never done before. But I got through it, and I was happy with the way I got through it. And I thought to myself, well, I don't have to fly anymore. I'll just go over to Channel 9. And that makes my job a lot and my life a lot easier. But I also knew that I was 78 at the time. But it was like, as I said to you earlier, it was like putting down my favorite pet. It was like taking away my toy, my hobby, and my pastime. But I also knew I couldn't call any better. And to me, there was a good chance from there it was going to be south, not north. But I wanted to sit as a viewer and watch it and see how I reacted. And I'm being serious now. And I watched the early part of the year in 2022, and I got through it okay. And I thought, life's been good to me. I've done everything I can do. There's nothing else I can achieve. All I can do is go down from here. So I just pulled the pin. But I don't think I made a fanfare of it, no.
I just want to finish with a simple question, if you don't mind. Do you miss it?
Oh, absolutely. Massively. Massively. You know, when you're 80 years of age and somebody takes your favourite pet, takes it away to the vet and says it won't be coming back, that I can't do that. I get somebody else to take it. But I could have kept going and made a fool of myself, I suppose, but... No, but your questions okay, good. I miss it enormously, yeah.
Ray Warren, great to catch up with you. What a journey, what a career, and now what a legacy. Well done on all you've done, for which the accolades still come, and best of luck with everything ahead of you, and thanks for sharing your story with us.
My pleasure, Sam. It was a nice interview, and I've enjoyed it.
You've been listening to This Is Your Journey for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. You can jump online and you can find them at tobinbrothers.com.au, and we'll catch you the next time we celebrate another great sporting journey.